Hi there, my name is Vic Veer. I'm an ENT surgeon working in the NHS in Central London. I work at the Royal National ENT Hospital in Central London in the sleep department there. And I also work at Queen's Hospital and King George's Hospital in Essex, which is just outside London. My job primarily on the NHS is to help people with snoring and sleep apnea issues. And my job as a surgeon is to help them if they haven't been able to get on with the traditional treatments such as CPAP, mandibular advancement device, and other devices. My job is to try and help them with surgery to effectively make it easier for them to use these devices or cure them completely of their obstructive sleep apnea. Now, I have a YouTube channel, almost 200 something videos there, and I can sort of guess that it's quite hard to navigate all the way through this. So that was one of the original ideas of me setting up this podcast, which was to allow me to talk for longer because I quite like talking, and secondly, to give you more of a broader overview of some things. I think I will use this podcast from time to time to put into lots of detail a particular subject, which would be a little bit too difficult to do on YouTube. But for this first podcast that I'm going to do today, I am going to try and give you a brief overview of sleep apnea treatment as it stands in the NHS at the moment. When I say NHS, just in case you're listening from abroad, I'm talking about the UK. This is a National Health Service NHS, and so this is the treatment you can get here for free at the point of contact. And then I'll also talk to you about how to get treatment on the NHS. Easiest and quickest way through the system to get the treatment that you really need, because it is an unbelievably difficult subject. And I can understand why people get frustrated and just give up, which I think really is the wrong thing to do. So hopefully, as long as you don't mind listening to me for such a long time, this will give you a brief overview of all of these things and how to sort of get started on this little journey. Now, primarily, it's going to be for the basics, people who don't know anything really about sleep disordered breathing, but I will throw in some information which people who know an awful lot about sleep apnea may have not realized or something that's new to them as well. So I'll try not to bore everyone, but some things may go over your head if you're not completely aware of this problem. So if you're new to this, I'm basically talking about, in its most basic form, something known as sleep disordered breathing. Which means that when you breathe at night, you get a partial obstruction. And I will be talking about the other things as well, but you get a partial obstruction of your airway so that you can't breathe quite as easily. In the simplest form, you get snoring because the throat is closed up a little bit to the point where it's some of the tissues are flapping around in the wind, causing that noise that we all know as snoring. It could be obstructive sleep apnea, means that the airway completely closes up and you can't breathe, and the body reacts rather poorly to this, either by losing oxygen or waking you up ever so slightly so you can take that deep breath. But there are other things as well, which I'll come back to later. Now, sleep disordered breathing has an awful lot of problems associated with it. And I'm not going to go over this in a lot of detail. I can leave that for another podcast. But having obstructive sleep apnea, which is normally classified as mild, moderate, or severe. And when you get to moderate levels, that means that you stop breathing, you need to sort of partly wake up, or you lose a bit of oxygen. If that happens to you about 15 times an hour, in these situations, you generally have problems with things like high blood pressure. Now, a lot of people feel like, oh, it can't be me then because I don't have high blood pressure. But I do have a video on my YouTube channel which explains that actually a lot of people with obstructive sleep apnea do have high blood pressure, except it's often not seen in the early stages during the day. So if you were to check your blood pressure now as you're sitting here and you know you have obstructive sleep apnea, it may be entirely normal. But we do know that as your sleep apnea gets worse, so does your blood pressure. And the first time you notice this is during the night. So your blood pressure, rather than dipping slightly at night, it seems to go up, which is unusual, or it doesn't go down at all. So what I mean by this is that when you're sleeping, you don't really need such a high blood pressure. You're lying down flat. The heart doesn't need to pump blood so aggressively to get up to your head because gravity is not stopping the blood from going up to your head. And so you don't have to pump so hard with the heart because you're at rest. You're trying to sleep. But in people with obstructive sleep apnea, often they aren't at rest. And therefore, even though the blood pressure should be going down, often it doesn't go down at all. It stays at the same level as it is during the day. Or it even goes up at night and then comes back to a normal blood pressure during the day. When you see blood pressure going up during the day, you know, halfway through the disease, you know, that happens later on. So You've missed a few years of this happening. Knowing that you've got high blood pressure and the fact that you snore suggests that this is causing a big problem. But there are other things. Let's start with the heart things. There's something known as atrial fibrillation. That's when the heart electrical activity is disturbed. So what I mean by that is that the heart has a beat and it keeps pumping your heart at a relatively regular beat, but sometimes it needs to go faster, sometimes it goes a bit slower. This is all controlled by an electrical system within the heart that allows it to beat normally. Obstructive sleep apnea can push you into something known as atrial fibrillation, which is when the heartbeat goes a little bit irregular, and it can cause problems in people when the irregular heartbeat occurs and not enough blood goes around the system, either because it's going too quickly or it's going too slowly, because there's no real control over the heartbeat anymore. If it goes too quickly, not enough blood gets into the heart to get pumped out, and so you start getting a backup. If it goes too slowly, the heart sort of gets expanded with the amount of blood inside it and can't squeeze it out quickly enough to get around the body. Atrial fibrillation sometimes isn't noticed at all, but sometimes it can cause a big problem. The way to really test for this, it's quite easy, I guess, is to put your finger on your pulse, either in your neck or on your wrist near your thumb. Feel if you have a regular heartbeat. But if it's going dup, 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 you know, something irregular, then it's worth perhaps talking to your doctor about it. So feeling your pulse and just noticing if it's irregular. Sometimes you can get the occasional missed beat or an additional beat, which is often known as an ectopic. Again, worth seeing your GP about, but that isn't atrial fibrillation. Now, obstructive sleep apnea or other sleep-disordered breathings can also cause, if you've got high blood pressure, you've got atrial fibrillation, you can go on to cause other problems, for example, like the heart attacks, because that's when a clot occurs within the blood vessels of the actual heart. When that happens, it can't beat quite as well and not enough blood goes around your system. So that's why it's so dangerous. Other vessels can be affected by these clots. The most worrying is the clots that occur within the brain. And that's known as a stroke or a cerebrovascular event. And there are different types of this, but heart attacks and strokes are more common in people with obstructive sleep apnea and sleep-disordered breathing, so it's worth knowing about. With the strain on the system, it can also cause diabetes and also other things such as weight gain. A lot of people in the past used to think that, well, the only reason you've got sleep apnea is because you've gained too much weight. Just lose the weight and it'll all get better. And I've got a video which sort of explains that. Although that can happen to some people, particularly if you're obese or morbidly obese, in actual fact, it's normally that the sleep apnea comes first and then you start gaining the weight. And the way I describe it in my video is that if you're being woken up, and as I said before, moderate sleep apnea is about 15 times an hour you stop or lose oxygen. Imagine being woken up by your partner, say, 15 times an hour all through the night. That's quite stressful and not very pleasant. And that can cause an awful lot of stress for your system. Until just about 100, 150 years ago, not many of us had many problems apart from starvation, famine. Those are the main stresses in our systems for the last several millennia. Famine, starvation, sort of sickness, poor harvests, bad winters, etc. All these things are the things that humans normally had to battle with. That was our biggest priority. So when our bodies are stressed, we're hardwired to prepare for famine or starvation. If the body's stressed, it holds on to fat and makes sure it doesn't lose it. But in this situation, it's not that we're being starved or there's a stress of a famine coming on or a poor harvest. The problem is that you're being woken up several times a night, but the body has incorrectly interpreted this as a stress due to something else. So it holds on to fat, which makes obviously your obstructive sleep apnea worse because you're trying to breathe through a narrower airway now. And so it's a vicious cycle that makes you gain weight, get more sleep apnea, and then you gain more weight. And so breaking that cycle is very difficult, particularly if all your hormones and everything are trying to make you hold on to fat when actually you're trying to lose it so you get your sleep apnea better. The same thing happens with high lipids and cholesterol and things like that. There are other things that obstructive sleep apnea, sleep-disordered breathing causes. People don't realize that sleep deprivation, obstructive sleep apnea, sleep-disordered breathing, they all seem to cause depression. And interestingly, depression also causes sleep-disordered breathing. And we think this is because depression isn't just a simple, just pull yourself together, you're just a little bit low mood or something. We all get into low mood sometimes. It's not that at all. It's a pathological problem. And it means that we think that there's reduced neuronal activity going to your throat. That means the nerves aren't firing quite as strongly as they used to before. It's almost, it's very much an organic disease. If the body isn't spitting out the same amount of information or sending out the right signals to the body, and the throat is not getting the same signals it used to, it can collapse purely because of depression. So again, a vicious cycle where the obstructive sleep apnea is causing the depression, depression is causing the obstructive sleep apnea. Infertility is another thing. A lot of people don't realize that sometimes if you're snoring but you're having difficulty in conceiving, it might be because you're not creating enough sperm, or if you're female, your body isn't preparing itself to have a baby. So if you imagine, if you are going through starvation, going back to my caveman analogy again, if you are going through starvation or about to start a famine or something like that, your body's not going to put you through such a difficult scenario where you're pregnant, about to have a baby and have another mouth to feed, if you're struggling to feed yourself at the same time. So it stops you from becoming fertile and doesn't allow you to bring a baby into the world, because it uses up an awful lot of resources. It'll only let you do that in a time of plenty as such. So when your body is working well, you're not gained too much weight, you're not lost too much weight, and you're not too stressed. So it's very difficult, you know, if it's trying to say that to patients, that, look, it may be because of your sleep that you're not conceiving. But it is one of those things out there. Now, I mentioned at the start, I wouldn't be talking about the side effects very much, but I think it is important. And it's important to know why we're putting ourselves through all this treatment. The main reason is that it has an awful lot of effects on your life expectancy. With all the high blood pressure, atrial fibrillation, heart attacks, strokes, depression, all these things, weight gain, it causes a reduction in your life expectancy. So there are trials out there that show that untreated obstructive sleep apnea, there's about 24-26% chance of death within the first 5 years. The life expectancy is said to be reduced by about 20 years. So that's roughly 58 years old for a man and about 62 years old for a woman in this country, in the UK. So it's important when we hear those stats and you go, oh God, I've only got 1 year left. No, remember that that's an average. Some people have had sleep apnea for many years and it slowly builds up over time. If you've only just started having problems and you're 57 years old, it doesn't mean that you've only got 1 year left. That's just the average life expectancy. Some people live very long, some people don't live quite as long. But the point I'm trying to make is that it's serious and it causes problems, and you should really try and get this sorted as soon as possible. So I've told you about all these things. Now, what do I do about it? How do I know whether or not this is the right thing to do? Do I go and bother my GP about it, or how do I know if I've got obstructive sleep apnea? So that really is the first question. There are plenty of signs that you can look at to try and work out whether or not you have a problem with your sleep. The first is snoring is very likely to be associated if you have obstructive sleep apnea. So 98% of people with obstructive sleep apnea do snore. There are very few people who don't snore with obstructive sleep apnea, but that's either because they're very, very severe, so basically they choke all night rather than make that characteristic sort of snoring noise, or it's because they have something else known as upper airway resistance syndrome, which I'll come back to in a minute. So if you are a loud snorer, and when I say loud, so loud that you can hear it through a closed door, then really there might well be a chance that you've got obstructive sleep apnea. So it's something you should be taking a note of. If you're waking up at night to go to the toilet to pass water, then that is a good sign of someone with obstructive sleep apnea, particularly if you snore at the same time. Some people don't quite make that connection. They go, well, I just go for a wee. It's probably because I had a bit too much water to drink before I went to bed. The reason this doesn't happen to normal people is because there is a hormone that's released in your body. And this atrial natriuretic peptide, I can't say it very well, but ANP, this hormone is released from the heart. And whilst you sleep, it controls the amount that your kidneys start excreting, so that your kidneys make urine. The point is that the body doesn't want you to fill up your bladder and disturb your sleep, because sleep's really important. So if if you are constantly being woken up at night, the body gets fooled into thinking it's morning. So it starts filling up the bladder because first thing in the morning, it starts clearing out the kidneys again. And then you go for a wee. If you're being woken up, say 15 times an hour or 30 times an hour, if you've got severe sleep apnea, the body's tricked into thinking that it's morning. This peptide, AMP, gets a little confused and doesn't know what to do. And eventually your bladder fills up overnight, even though it really shouldn't be. You go for a wee and you go back to sleep again. You realize, oh, I'm just being disturbed by my bladder being too full. Maybe I've got a prostate problem, or maybe I haven't done my pelvic floor exercises, women might say. You know, there's all sorts of things that make sense to us intuitively. We don't often attribute it to the snoring noise that's very loud and can be heard through a closed door. So if you're waking up a lot at night, then think about, particularly if you're snoring, that you might have obstructive sleep apnea. There are other things that can happen during the day. You might wake up in the morning with a headache. Lasts maybe half an hour, sometimes a bit longer. But those sorts of headaches we often attribute to people with low oxygen levels at night. It's not always because of that. Sometimes just the stress of not getting very much sleep and being sleep deprived. But if you have low oxygen levels, you may often wake up in the morning with a terrible headache. And once you've taken a half an hour of sort of breathing, your headache seems to go away. You don't need the paracetamol or you know, Nurofen or whatever you take for morning headaches. It might simply be because you're not getting enough oxygen at night. If you imagine waking up several times at night, the other thing that can happen is that you may be tired. You may not just be getting very deep, restful sleep because you keep getting woken up from deep and restful sleep. So people with obstructive sleep apnea may be tired. It's not always the case. Sometimes people just sleep more and carry on sleeping until they get the sleep that they need. It's not very good quality sleep. That's why they extend the quantity of it so that they can function during the day. So being tired is a feature of obstructive sleep apnea, but you can have very, very severe obstructive sleep apnea and not feel tired at all. And it might be because, you know, you just sleep more. It might be because you've just forgotten what normal is. Often patients come up to me and say, no, I'm not tired at all. But when you fix their obstructive sleep apnea, out of nowhere, they come back to you and go, oh my God, I did not realize how tired I was before. I can't believe I walked around for so long not knowing how tired and sort of exhausted I was. I feel so different now. I've got a real lease of life now, and I've got a real bounce in my step, and I can concentrate, and I don't have brain fog and things like that. So it's important to realize or be able to work out whether or not you're tired, and it's often difficult. I did mention also just a second ago that people with obstructive sleep apnea often have a brain fog or difficulty in concentrating. Their vigilance levels are lower. Sometimes, particularly with something known as REM associated sleep apnea, that means you only get the sleep apnea during dream sleep. In that situation, people, although they don't have a very high score for their obstructive sleep apnea, their severity is quite low. They only get sleep apnea during dreams and they keep waking up in the middle of their dreams. These people generally have problems with brain fog. They have difficulty with concentration. Learning new things becomes very difficult for them. A lot of these people have problems with driving, trying to sort of concentrate and stay vigilant whilst driving. So all of these things may be associated with having sleep apnea only during dreams. And I'll try and come back to that as well. So if any of these things resonate with you, if you're a loud snorer, if you've got high blood pressure, if you're gaining weight without even trying to gain weight, and you're trying to lose weight, but you still can't do it, if you're infertile, if you've got problems with going for a wee at night, all of these symptoms and signs you should look out for. And if you have these things, it may be worth considering whether or not you have obstructive sleep apnea. It would be lovely to go to a GP at this stage, a general practitioner or a family doctor, whatever you want to call it, and say, look, I think I've got a problem here. Can I get some treatment? But the reality is, in today's modern NHS, everyone is really stretched. GPs are busier than anyone at the moment, and I feel really sorry for them. It's very, very hard for them to learn all different types of medicine and to keep up to date with everything. To make it slightly easier for the GPs, I have a list of questionnaires that I provide for free on the internet. In the notes, hopefully there's a chance to put notes into this podcast. I haven't tried to study talking, obviously, and I hope that this is having some benefit for someone out there. But if I'm allowed to do notes, I'll put a link in there to go to my free online questionnaires. These questionnaires include the stop-bang questionnaire. This stop-bang questionnaire is really the best way of working out whether or not you may have obstructive sleep apnea. It's the only really good validated score, rather than a sleep study, which I'll come back to. But the stop-bang questionnaire works out whether or not you have a low, intermediate, or high risk of obstructive sleep apnea. These 8 questions you fill out, and it will spit out an answer at the end. You can just look on the internet. There is a free website, and you can look at that and fill that out. And it will give it there as well. But I've got it on my list of, I think, 5 or 6 questionnaires. And if you have an intermediate or high risk of obstructive sleep apnea, the idea is to go to your GP with your evidence in hand and say, look, I've got a high stop-bang score. It says I might have obstructive sleep apnea or a sleep disordered breathing. Can I please be referred on to a sleep center, or may I have a sleep study? And what you're doing is giving the GP a little bit of evidence so that they know that you've followed through a system and you've tried to diagnose yourself, rather than you going there and trying to convince them of a problem when you've got sort of relatively hard evidence-based proof in your hand that there may be a problem. It's not just the stop-bang score on this list of questionnaires. I've got something known as the STAMP score. The STAMP score is something I invented. It stands for symptoms, and some of the symptoms I talked to you about before. T for tiredness, A for alertness, M for mood, P for psychosocial. These are 5 different domains. It's not meant to diagnose obstructive sleep apnea. It's meant to show how bad you feel at the moment. And it is quite useful, because it's useful to see if there's a difference between one time and another time. Say if you wanted to do it now, and then you lost 10 kilos in weight, and then you did it again, and you want to see what the benefit was to you, not your sleep study, which I said I'd come back to, but how you feel internally. That is quite useful. Or if you're going to try a device like a CPAP device or a mandibular advancement device, all these things I'll talk about later. If you want to see the difference something has made to your life, then this STAMP score can be quite useful. I've also got something known as a visual analog score for snoring. This is not particularly useful, because there are, you know, newer apps out there now, like Snore Lab and Snore Clock and all those sorts of things. These are things that monitor how loud your snoring is. And some of you, if you followed me in the past, know that I tried to make an app myself, but it got hacked and I lost an awful lot of money on it. That's no longer there. But something that monitors the loudness of your snoring at night is quite useful. If you don't have one of these apps on your phone, it helps you say to your GP, look, my snoring is 8 out of 10 or 10 out of 10. There's a brief guide at the bottom. So it's not a proper VAS score, which has 0 to 10, how loud is your snoring? It gives you a little pointer along the way, because there's an awful lot of emotion attached to snoring. And everyone, if you ask them how loud is your snoring, they'll all say 10. But then when you said, well, I had a patient the other day who snored so loudly in a detached house that the neighbors in the next house along, 2 walls away, was woken up. Or some patients who wake up the entire street and the police have to get involved. Oh, are you as loud as that? And you go, oh, well, no, I guess that's a 10. Then I'll be a 9. I said, well, so, and then you can come up with all sorts of things. So it just helps you classify vaguely where you are in that scale. As a brief pointer, I've said in that scale, if you're at 8 out of 10, that means that you're constantly in a separate room from your partner. You're not sleeping in the same bed. It's not a fantastic score, but it is quite useful for us sometimes to see how you're getting along. Other questionnaires in this list of questionnaires I give out is something known as the Insomnia Severity Index. That's a score that tells you how well you are sleeping at night. So that means, do you wake up often at night and can't get back to sleep? Does it take you a long time to get to sleep in the morning, at night, should I say? Or do you wake up early in the morning and just can't get enough sleep? So it's basically saying there's no problem apart from the fact you just can't get enough sleep at night and you're tired during the day. That's important, because obstructive sleep apnea, upper airway resistance syndrome, all these things, these sleep disordered breathing issues, can cause insomnia. So it's worth knowing about it. If you remember before, I talked a little bit about tiredness. There is a score for tiredness called the Epworth Sleepiness Scale. I don't really like it. And if you've watched some of my videos on Epworth score, you'll know that I really dislike this score, mainly because people use it as a screening test. That's rather old school. You know, we shouldn't be using the Epworth score. It's not used for screening for obstructive sleep apnea. It's not been validated for that use. But what it does do is help respiratory physicians work out which patients would do well with CPAP. Because if you have got moderate to severe obstructive sleep apnea, that means you stop breathing more than 15 times an hour, and you are very tired, if you score more than 16 on the Epworth score, well, then in that situation, you're very likely to find benefit from using a CPAP device. A CPAP device is a mask that goes over your face and pumps air into your lungs at night. In people who are very, very tired and have moderate to severe sleep apnea, CPAP really does help those people and they feel much better for it. You can have, as I said before, completely normal tiredness levels and have very severe obstructive sleep apnea. You can't really use the Epworth score as a screening test to find out whether or not you have sleep apnea, but it is useful for the respiratory physicians to work out whether or not you would be a good candidate for CPAP. I talked at one point about anxiety and depression, well, mostly depression I talked about, but there is something known as a HADS score. So that's a hospital anxiety and depression score. It's another questionnaire now, which talks about your mood, how depressed or anxious you're feeling, because these are things that come up with people with sleep disturbance. And so these are all important questionnaires, which are listed in one big questionnaire. And at the end of filling out all those questionnaires, there's a report that comes up on the page that will tell you what your scores are for each of these questionnaires. That's quite useful. But if you did put your email address in, then you'd get a report being sent to you, which explains each of these score levels. So it tells you, look, an Epworth score over 8 means that you're tired, over 16 means that you're very tired, all that sort of stuff. At the end, it sort of goes into a tiny bit of detail where I point you to different sort of videos on my YouTube channel so that you know where to look and where to get started. So these questionnaires are there to help you to get some evidence about your symptoms. And so you can show this to your GP, and you can get going to work out exactly where you should go to get the treatment that you really need. Guess what? I have just forgotten one of my questionnaires. One was called the nose questionnaire, and it tells you how blocked your nose is. And it gives you a relatively good way of telling your GP, look, my nose is blocked. I'd like treatment for it. Or can I be referred on for treatment for it? So the idea of these questionnaires is to go to your GP with your report and show, look, I've done all these validated questionnaires. Here are my results. I'd like to get treatment for all of these. The most important is the stop bang if you're trying to work out whether or not you have obstructive sleep apnea. As I said before, if you're intermediate or high risk, that's a very, very good way of working out whether or not you should have a sleep study. A sleep study, also known as a polysomnography, is a device that you wear at night. And what it does is it often sits on your chest and there's wires coming off it, or they're Bluetooth synced with each other. And these devices, which go onto your finger, which collect information about your blood oxygen levels or your pulse, there's straps across your chest to see how hard you're breathing, how much strain you're to try and get air in and out. There's sometimes nasal cannula, little prongs that go into your nose that monitors how much air comes in and out of your nose. So there's all sorts of interesting monitors that are going on each of these nights that you're wearing this sleep study for. And it works out how loud your snoring is, how hard you're breathing, what your oxygen levels are, how often you stop breathing. All of these things are recorded in the device. And then the next day, it's either uploaded or someone comes over to pick up the information and we analyze all that data. Every breath has to be looked at. And on the back of that, they can say, yes, you stop breathing more or less than 15 times an hour. It's called the AHI, that's the apnea hypopnea index, is the most basic thing that they look for. Apneas mean complete blockage of your breathing. And so you can't breathe at all for at least 10 seconds. Your oxygen levels drop a little bit. Or hypopneas, which is the other one in the AHI. And hypopneas are like apneas, but not quite as bad. And the index means the number of apneas, hypopneas per hour on average over the whole night. So that's what the AHI is. And in its most basic form, that's what a sleep study does. It checks to work out how high your AHI is. And if it's greater than 5, it means that you have mild sleep apnea. If it's greater than 15, you have moderate. If it's greater than 30, you would have severe obstructive sleep apnea. It's a little bit more complicated than that. And I don't think I'll go into it at this point, but you can get AHIs of up to 120 or so. Some of these people at 100, 120 don't feel that bad, whereas some people with an AHI of 6 feel awful. There is the concept known as phenotypes, which again, I'll talk about in another podcast. It's too much for this one because it's not a very good way of working out whether or not you have obstructive sleep apnea. It's the way we use, but there are a lot of limitations to trying to express someone's entire sleep based on one relatively simple number. But it's what we use at the moment, and this is the thing that most doctors would want to look at. In amongst sleep studies, there are some really simple ones and some very, very advanced ones. So I'll quickly go over that. I think the absolute minimum is something known as a watch pat. It looks like a watch with a wire going onto the end of your finger. It mostly monitors your pulse, oxygen levels, and some other things as well. It is very good as a screening test again. So if you're almost certain the person in front of you has moderate or severe obstructive sleep apnea, and really you want to get on and give them treatment for their obstructive sleep apnea because you know they already have it, you just want to prove it, well then a watch pat is excellent for that. It's very good at picking up people with moderate or severe obstructive sleep apnea. It's a bit sketchy when you're trying to work out if they are normal or mild sleep apnea. So it's not that useful for that end of the scale. It's also not particularly useful for people with upper airway resistance syndrome because, again, it's not very good at that mild end of scale. It is a really useful, simple sleep study, which is often disposable as well. You just wear it and throw it in the bin once the data has been downloaded. Yes, a watch pat is probably the minimum sort of sleep study you can get out there. Now, I personally quite like the NOTS, so it's NOX-T3S. That's a really good sleep study because it covers the mild problems as well, and particularly if you use it for 3 days, it's a lot easier to pick up things like upper airway resistance syndrome. And I'll explain what that is. Upper airway resistance syndrome is not sleep apnea where you completely stop breathing and you lose a bit of oxygen and things like that, and you sort of woken up a little bit. Upper airway resistance syndrome is where you don't stop breathing at all, but you do have, as the name suggests, you do have restriction in your airway, a constriction of your airway. So you're sort of having to breathe through a very narrow passage, and that can cause snoring. It sounds more like very excessive wheezing, really. It's not like a true sort of snoring, which feels like it's coming from your nose, although snoring doesn't really come from your nose. Upper airway resistance syndrome is typically, and it's quite hard to pick out, it's typically younger people or people who are just starting on their sleep apnea sort of journey, and they have problems mostly lying on their back or during dream sleep. But when they roll on their side, they're still not great because they have upper airway resistance syndrome on their side. So they are able to breathe. They are able to get air in and out of their lungs. It's just they have to work really, really hard to get air in and out of their lungs. And in some cases, the definition, because there are two definitions that are commonly used for this, instead of using the AHI, because the AHI is normal in people with upper airway resistance syndrome, there's something that's based on a flow limitation. That means the airflow has been restricted. And because of that, even though they're not stopping breathing or not meeting the criteria for those AHIs, those apneas and hypopneas, then we would say, maybe you have upper airway resistance syndrome. There are also respiratory events which, again, don't meet the criteria for an apnea or hypopnea, but they do seem to cause a slight arousal. You slightly wake up. And because of that, so it's about this arousal, which or sometimes we call them RERAs, R-E-R-As. These things can be used as a way of picking up people with upper airway resistance syndrome. There's an awful lot out there about this sort of sub-problem within sleep-disordered breathing. Sleep-disordered breathing covers the whole range, the whole spectrum of problems from snoring, sleep apnea, obstructive sleep apnea, and this one, upper airway resistance syndrome. Personally, I don't like to think of it as a spectrum where snoring's at one end and very severe obstructive sleep apnea is at the other end and upper airway resistance syndrome is in the middle, because you can have all three at the same time. As I said, people with very severe obstructive sleep apnea tend to be loud snorers. And in that little example I gave earlier, some people have bad sleep apnea lying on their back, but when they roll on their side, they have upper airway resistance syndrome. It gets a bit more complex, obviously, and I'm trying not to make this complex. This is meant to be a good grounding on people who just started this little getting into the world of sleep-disordered breathing. So I'll try not to make it too difficult. On saying that, the proper way of working out whether or not, or the gold standard way of working out whether or not upper airway resistance syndrome, is something called an esophageal mammometry. That's basically a little tube with a pressure sensor in it. So if you were to pinch it, it would notice it. And if you were to stretch it or stretch the air around it, it would dilate a little bit and the sensor would pick it up as well. So this thing is pushed up your nose. This tube is pushed down the back of your throat into your esophagus, the gullet, and it sits there whilst you are sleeping. Because of the pressure changes in your heart and lungs, if you're trying to take a really deep breath or trying to breathe very hard, this notices the big pressure changes that occur at night. That would be the way during a sleep study that is the gold standard way of working out whether or not you have upper airway resistance syndrome. I have this not on the NHS, unfortunately. I've only got this privately. But I think the reason for it is that it's really expensive and 20% of people find it very difficult to tolerate. You imagine this tube running from your nose down the back of your throat into your sort of swallowing pipe, the gullet. It's difficult for people to tolerate it. It's hard for them to sleep with this thing in their throat at night. And this brings me on to the third of the sleep studies. This is even more advanced from the WatchPat was the earliest one. Then the NOX T3S was the middle one, which I think is the best sort of home sleep study you can get for breathing problems. The best one, I think, on the market right now for all the bells and whistles to pick up all sorts of things is known as the SomnoMed Sleep Study or the SMED. That's really useful because it covers all the brainwave data. It's got a video on you. It's got all sorts of things. It uses that esophageal mammometry if you want to add that on. So it's really helpful, not just with sleep apnea, but also with all the other sleep problems that can happen. There are a bunch of sleep apnea problems called parasomnias. So things like sleepwalking, sleep talking, epilepsy, all those sorts of things that can occur during sleep that aren't really related to breathing, but this SMED can cover all of those things in one. So it's can only be done one night, whereas the NOX T3S can go on for three nights. But it's a very, very, shall we say, high resolution sleep study. So it's quite useful in certain individuals like restless legs or, you know, all sorts of other diseases out there that affect people's sleep. So as I said before, once you've seen your GP, you've shown them the stop-bang score, which shows intermediate or high risk of sleep apnea. The first thing you're trying to get from your GP is a sleep study, and that's probably related to a sleep center. And if you get a high score, then they often get in contact with you, bring you in, and start the process of treatment. And there's lots of treatments out there. But if you remember, I've talked about depression, I've talked about infertility, I've talked about high blood pressure, all sorts of things that need not just a respiratory physician who gives CPAP, not just a dentist that gives a mandibular advancement device. A mandibular advancement device is like a gum shield that makes your lower jaw protrude forward a little bit. That's really useful because by moving your lower jaw forward, your tongue also moves forward. And it stops your tongue from falling back and blocking your breathing, particularly when you're sleeping on your back. So there are all sorts of people involved in the treatment of people with obstructive sleep apnea. And so what I think we should all be moving to, and I'm talking to doctors here, we should all be moving to an MDT system. So that means a multidisciplinary team meeting type thing, where all of these specialties come together. They all have their little niche area that they deal with people with obstructive sleep apnea or you know, with sleep disordered breathing. You end up seeing everyone to get the best possible care you possibly can. So respiratory physicians are really useful for CPAP and other lung problems that may be occurring with these patients. But you also need neurologists, like the sleep talking, restless leg syndrome problems that I talked about with the SomnoMed, SMED sleep study that can pick it up. Bariatrics, a lot of people have a lot of weight gain with their obstructive sleep apnea, and they need to see someone who can fix that. There's ENT people, ears, nose and throat people like me. We help out with obstructions in the airways, but not to do with the hard skeletal tissue in the face or facial skeleton, because that's where the maxillofacial surgeons come in. They're dentists plus. They have surgical skills as well as dental skills, and they change the shape of the facial skeleton to bring your jaw and the upper jaw forward by sort of breaking the jaws and realigning them again so your tongue can be pulled forward as well. So that's a really useful operation with about a 68 or slightly higher chance of success. For some reason, some people are saying that it's 100%, but it's clearly not. It's a very, very good operation. But remember, it also causes high blood pressure. It also causes atrial fibrillation, heart attacks, strokes, and things like that. So a cardiologist is very important. Insomnia psychiatry specialists are very important. So there's all sorts of different people out there who help with sleep and snoring problems. And so you need to see these people as a team, hopefully, to fix your problem. You've done your questionnaire, you've spoken to your GP, hopefully there will be a sleep center nearby and you'll see all of these people and get yourself treated. In reality, on the NHS, that's very, very difficult. But I hope that by making podcasts like this and videos like I do on my sleep study on my YouTube channel, hopefully we can get to the point where this is more of the norm rather than an exceptional thing that I'm trying to set up. But anyway, if you don't have that sort of setup, hopefully with questionnaires that you filled out, it may give you an idea of where to point to. For example, if your stop bang score was high, you get yourself a sleep study, and maybe from there you go on to the respiratory physicians to get a CPAP device. But if your nose score was high, then people might think, well, if your nose is blocked, maybe you should see an ENT surgeon. If you've got high insomnia problems, if the high insomnia severity index is very high, you may be referred on to an insomnia or psychiatry expert to help you with insomnia. And there's things like CBTI and things like that that can help with insomnia. So it really depends on what you've found and how much information you know about obstructive sleep apnea, because it's a very, very new field of medicine. It sort of came out 30, 40 years ago. So many of us have not, it hasn't filtered down to medical schools yet. So often people haven't had any training to do with sleep. And so it's unsurprising that a lot of GPs don't have an awful lot of information about it. You're there not to have a massive fight with them. We want them to be on our side as much as possible. And so you're turning up and very, very clearly say, look, these are my symptoms. These are the other things I've got going on with me, like raising blood pressure. I can't get my weight down. And here are my questionnaires that showed that I may have an obstructive sleep apnea problem. Can you please refer me for a sleep study or to the local sleep center? It's making their life easier so they can make your life easier. Anyway, I wanted to mention a few things, because once you've had your questionnaires, once you've had a think about your symptoms and signs and things like that, and once you've had your sleep study, you may be given a little bit more information about what is going on with you. Now, it's often doctors, I think inappropriately, believe that patients don't really understand sleep studies. And it's only because it takes a bit of time to work it out. When you first look at a sleep study, it'll just look like gobbledygook. There's just numbers and graphs everywhere. But there is a video on my channel which explains it in small amounts of detail about the things you should be looking for in your sleep study. Now, so do ask. Once you've had your sleep study, do ask for a copy of it. And if they won't give it to you, which is common in a lot of NHS centres, ask if you can take a picture of it with your phone on the screen, because none of us have really printers on the NHS. But if it's on the screen, you could ask the doctor, do you mind if I just take pictures on my phone of each of these pages of this sleep study? There's typically 4 or 5 pages with a few graphs on as well. So take them all in colour, keep it for your records, make sure you can see all the numbers. Because it is really useful and you can work out a lot from the sleep study, because it's not just that AHI number I keep talking about. There are loads of different numbers in there, and my little video on how to read your own sleep study may help you understand a bit more. So it's worth having a look at it in a lot of detail and working out exactly what type of obstructive sleep apnea you have. It may be that you have sleep apnea only when lying on your side. I had a patient today whose sleep apnea when lying on their side was about 65. So they stop breathing more than once every minute when they're lying on their back. But when they sleep on their side, it goes down to about 11. Now, 11 is much better. It's within the mild category. They stop breathing roughly once every 6 minutes or so. And it makes a massive difference, because if you know that you're only really bad when lying on your back, or, as I mentioned before, only really bad when you're dreaming. And what you do is you look at the sleep study, look at all the areas where you're dreaming on the big graph, and you'll see, at between 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning, I was dreaming. And you look at down the oxygen levels. If you see that the oxygen levels are getting dipping down or getting fuzzy, then you know that there's a problem with your sleep only during the REM or dream sleep. And then you think to yourself, well, why is that happening? Maybe if you're only getting problems during dream sleep, maybe I should explain that. Sorry. People often get problems when they dream because, well, a funny thing happens. Our bodies do not want us to act out our dreams. They don't want us to run around the house with a lightsaber fighting off goblins and dragons and things like that. But obviously, the body does not want us to do that. So when we go into a dream state, all the muscles in our body go even more limp than usual. So if you're lying on your back, trying to keep your tongue off the back wall of your throat so you can breathe, that ability to keep your tongue off the back wall of your throat goes when you're dreaming, because then all your muscles go limp and your tongue can fall right back and block your breathing. So that's one cause of sleep apnea only when you're lying on your back, or what's known as supine obstructive sleep apnea. And so you may have problems sleeping on your back, but even worse problems when you're sleeping on your back and dreaming. That makes an awful lot of sense, in the sense that your tongue falls back even more and you get really bad sleep apnea when those two things combine. So I've talked about different types of obstructive sleep apnea, the REM-associated or dream-associated sleep apnea, positional sleep apnea, sleeping on your side is better than sleeping on your back. And then there's things called central sleep apnea. That means you're not getting blocked, but you just decided not to breathe. Your brain has said, look, we're not going to give you the signals to breathe. Just don't breathe. So although there's no obstruction, you don't look like you're choking and you're desperate to breathe. You're just lying there going slightly blue. That's known as central sleep apnea. And it's actually vanishingly rare, although it often comes up in sleep studies for lots of reasons. And it's often an artifact. So it's either because we're giving too much CPAP, or it's because you're going very blue at night. So there's lots of different reasons that you can have central sleep apnea, which is of a consequence of something else rather than pure central sleep apnea, which could be caused by a stroke or something like that. So it's important to work out what type of central sleep apnea you have. And I've got a video on that as well. Another thing to be aware of, that there's a syndrome known as obesity hyperventilation syndrome. This is slightly off what we've been talking about so far. But this is when people who are very large, obese, shall we say, and they're particularly lying on their back, because there's so much weight on their chest, and because they're not putting so much effort into their breathing, because, you know, they're dreaming or sleeping, they're trying to rest, then end up not taking deep enough breaths to maintain their oxygen levels, or even get rid of the carbon dioxide in their system. So in these situations, you have a problem because there's so much weight on board, you're not taking deep enough breaths to ventilate yourself properly. And so that's known as obesity hyperventilation syndrome. So all of these things put together, there's snoring, obstructive sleep apnea with the REM associated or positional sleep apnea, there's central sleep apnea, there's upper airway resistance syndrome, there's obesity hyperventilation syndrome, and there's actually loads of phenotypes in there as well. So it is quite complicated, and trying not to confuse you, obviously, but I'm trying to show you that there's a big world out there outside the AHI number. And I just want you to be aware of it, because I think the worst thing is that people are told, oh, there's nothing wrong with your sleep. Your AHI is less than 5. Please go away. Once you've had your sleep study, even though your questionnaire says that you've got a problem, that's why I'm suggesting to you that you look at your sleep study, make sure you get a copy of it. Because often it's because you've got REM associated sleep apnea and your sleep is badly disturbed during dream sleep. And that's affecting you out of proportion to the rest of your sleep, because dream sleep is really, really important. And if you have to look on it to avoid someone else, a doctor, missing it, then you've got to take your health into your own hands and try and get this sorted out yourself. So look at that big graph. The big graph is the most important thing. The numbers generally are disregarded by people who like sleep apnea and sleep studies. The most important page on that, on your sleep study, is the big graph of the whole night. So that is really important. Look at when you're dreaming, look at when you're sleeping on your side, and see what happens to your oxygen levels, to your pulse rate, and you know, how much effort you're taking in your breathing. You can pick up all sorts of things. Maybe I should do another YouTube video about this. Anyway, going on with things. Now that you know how bad your sleep apnea is, the next thing you need to do is try and work out, who do I go and see? This is on the NHS, often it's a bit of a postcode lottery. If you live in a certain area, they'll send you to a local sleep team who may often be the respiratory physicians. And they'll look at you and give you the different options. And generally, it's a CPAP device in the first instance, or a mandibular advancement device. In some centres, they now provide these. In our centre at the Royal National ENT Hospital, we provide everything, including surgery and implants and things like that, which I'll talk about. But most places, will offer you CPAP. So you'll see a respiratory team who will give you this mask on your face. But whilst you're waiting to see them, try and figure out what you can do for yourself. So the things that typically they would look for would be looking for a blocked nose. And again, I'll bring you back to my questionnaires, which are available for free for anyone. The questionnaires will have a nose score in them. And you can say to them, look, yes, I know you're a respiratory physician, but my nose is blocked. And looking at the videos, you'll see that it's very hard to use CPAP with a blocked nose because it makes your nose even more blocked. And so I'd like to have treatment for my blocked nose, because even the national guidelines in this country say that if you've got a blocked nose, you should get that sorted first before rushing into CPAP. And if it happens that you're given CPAP first, that's fine. Please use it. And hopefully you can. But often people find it very difficult to use CPAP, the mask on your face, without unblocking your nose first. And there's lots of different ways of unblocking noses. There's also things called nasal dilators. And the simplest one was like a breathe right strip. It's like a little bit of sticky tape that goes over your nose and opens up your nose and stops the side walls of your nose collapsing in. And it helps you breathe around twists in your nasal airway. So for example, if the midline partition of your nose, which is called the septum, if that's twisted to one side, which you can't often see from the outside, but if it is twisted on the inside, one side of your nose will be more blocked than the other. So putting your finger on one side of your nose and blocking, say, the right-hand side and trying to breathe through the left-hand side and then swapping over to the other side, you might work out, actually, it feels like consistently my right nasal cavity is always blocked. Maybe I have a twist in my septum, which is causing it, or a deviated nasal septum. Or it could be that the lining of your nose is swollen up. And in that situation, it's often the turbinates, and you can look at my videos about turbinates, that can swell up and block your breathing as well. And typically for those people, seeing your GP and getting sprays, so nasal steroid sprays or different types of sprays, and as long as you choose the modern ones, they're a lot safer. You can get them over the counter in England. And I've got a video on how to take the sprays properly so you don't sniff it up, or, you know, all those things that people end up doing wrong. So if you look at that video, that will explain how to use nasal sprays correctly. And there are lots of different things we can do from a surgical standpoint, like just straightening out the septum, shrinking down the turbinates, getting rid of polyps, getting rid of adenoids, all those things that can open up the airway to get you to breathe better through your nose. There's also another video which explains why you should fix your nose first or at all in that matter. So look out for a blocked nose. It's really important, particularly even before having a CPAP device given to you. The other thing is tonsils. Typically as an adult, if you see your tonsils and they're big enough to be obviously seen in your mouth, it's probably a problem. The wonders of a podcast. I'm going to have to get used to this. So what happens here is if your tonsils are very big, they can block your airway. But typically, tonsils shrink in size after puberty. By the age of 20, most adults don't have tonsils anymore, or they're very, very small bits of fibrous tissue on the side of the throat. For you to continue having big tonsils that are blocking your airway is abnormal. And I think people don't realize that this is the case. Some time ago, last year, I wrote a book on tonsillectomy, how to remove your tonsils and all the things you should think about. And the thing that I got back most of the time was that, oh, I didn't realize tonsils weren't meant to be there. I had big tonsils all my life. I thought everyone did. But when you look in most people's throats who are adults, you won't see tonsils. If you ask them, did you have tonsils removed as a child? They go, no, but they were huge. I kept having infections when I was a child. But when you look now, they've almost disappeared because we don't really need them after childhood. And we don't hardly need them at all before childhood either. But that's all in the book. You can read that later if you really want to. Looking at tonsils is really important. Again, on the national guidelines, it says that you should look for tonsils and remove tonsils often before you start having CPAP therapy. Because if you've got these big red meatballs in your throat, how is the air puffing through this mask going to ever get past those big meatballs? They've got nowhere to go. So it's really important to look at that. There's a thing called lateral pharyngeal cushions. Well, at least that's what I call them. If you look at the back of your throat, not at the dangly thing, the uvula hanging down, not at the tonsils left and right, but the wall behind all of that stuff, you know, before which it goes down into your airway, that wall can look very creased and swollen, congested on the left and right, just behind where the tonsils are or used to be. That is a really good indicator that the side wall of your throat is collapsing in. And we don't really understand why that happens in some people. We believe, well, we're not really sure about this. Sometimes I like to describe it as, you know, those guys who are in the street and they're using a jackhammer to break through concrete, and it's sort of drilling through the street or the road. After a few years of doing that job, they lose the sensation in their fingers, or something known as vibration white finger. And because the nerves don't work very well, they can't do that job anymore. The same thing we think happens to the throat with a vibration, and it causes the nerves not to work, so you don't get as much tone and the airway keeps collapsing at night. So if you see these lateral pharyngeal cushions behind where the tonsils used to be or where they are now, it may be that the sidewall of your throat is collapsing in and stretching it past its elastic limit. That's why it looks all creased. That's a good sign that you've got severe obstructive sleep apnea. You should look at your tongue as well. The tongue may be large. Ask them to open their mouth as wide as you can, and you can't even see the uvula, the dangly thing at the back of their throat. Or you can barely see parts of their throat apart from the hard palate, you know, the roof of your mouth. So in these situations, you'd say, oh, look, you've got quite a big tongue there. And if you look around the edge of the tongue, or the circumference of it, you might see little indents of where the teeth used to be. We call that a scalloped tongue. Again, that would say that you've got a very big tongue. I'm not certain that it's always because you've got a big tongue. You're just born with a big tongue. It may be that you have a small jaw or a receding jaw, and there's just not enough room for a normal sized tongue. So all of these things you can look out for when you're waiting to see a doctor in a sleep center. And whilst you're waiting to see someone, it may be worth looking back at your sleep study and thinking, well, maybe I sleep better when I'm sleeping on my side. So you'd look at your apnea hypopnea index, the AHI, which could be 20. And then you say, well, I've got moderate sleep apnea. But then when you look at the AHI when you're lying on your back, you might say, wow, it's 60. It's really bad when I'm lying on my back. But when I'm lying on my side, it goes away. I'm less than 5. So on average for the whole night, I'm 20 because it's a weighted mean, we call it. But if you have a problem with positional sleep apnea and you know that sleeping on your side basically cures you, in inverted commas, then you should sleep on your side. It's a no-brainer. So getting a pillow that helps you sleep on your side is really important. Some of you will know that I'm making a pillow. In fact, I just put the order in again to try and make the pillow. We had a bit of a problem with the factory. They're going to make me one pillow so I can have a look at it. And then, fingers crossed, I can start producing this thing. Anyway, this is a pillow that helps people sleep on their side without it causing hip problems, neck problems, ear problems, and be able to breathe properly, let your tongue roll out the way. But sleeping on your side has to be comfortable, or otherwise you'll just sleep on your back. But there are other things you can do. That you can wear a backpack. So I often tell people about the slumber bump or a woody nose backpack. These backpacks stop you from being able to sleep on your back, because it's a bit like being a tortoise. You just physically can't roll over. There are electronic devices that, like a little strap, that like a little seatbelt that goes around your belly. And so every time you lie on your back, it recognizes that you're lying on your back using a little sort of gyrometer inside there, like on phones when you turn it to one side or the other. And when that happens, it starts vibrating and waking you up slightly so that you roll onto your side. And the idea is that it trains you to sleep on your side rather than on your back, which is a little less cumbersome than having a huge backpack on at night. Anyway, these are all things that would help if you have positional sleep apnea. If you know that you are overweight and you think you can fix that, because it's very hard to fix, a large BMI if you're overweight and you've got bad sleep apnea, it's very, very hard to lose weight. But if you think you can, do so, because it's really, really useful. If you lost 10 kilos of weight, you make a massive difference to your overall health. You do need to bring your BMI down to between 20 and 25, 23 really. If you can bring your BMI down to a relatively normal level, it will improve your sleep apnea by at least 30, 40%. It's very unlikely to cure you, because weight is very rarely going to fix obstructive sleep apnea, but it certainly makes a massive difference. So if you can lose the weight, do so. It's also worth thinking about very strenuous, intense exercise, because that reduces the amount of visceral fat that you have. Visceral fat is the type of fat that you can get around your organs. So around your liver, around your kidneys, around your heart and things like that. It's the sort of the worst type of fat, I guess. But the same sort of fat happens within your tongue, within the sidewalls of your throat. So we've moved away a little bit from how big is your collar size, which is what we often did in the past. But actually, visceral fat in your tongue, in the sidewalls of your throat, seem to be more important. Although weight loss tablets and injections are very useful, the best way to get rid of visceral fat is doing very intense intermittent exercise. I think they call it HITS, or high intensity interval training, something like that, where you sprint up a hill for about sort of 5 to 10 seconds, and then you're sweating at the top, and then you walk your way down, catch your breath, and then do the whole thing again and keep doing it. And that very, very fast running up a hill, very strenuous type of exercise, but giving yourself a chance to breathe in between each one, is meant to be really good for getting rid of visceral fat. There are simple things like stopping snoring. Oops, that's not the right word. Stopping smoking, should I say. Stopping drinking. Drinking alcohol is terrible for you. Drinking alcohol makes all the muscles in your throat collapse, and you get much worse sleep apnea. Plus, also gets rid of your dream sleep, so you wake up with even less ability to concentrate, think clearly, and you're very sleep deprived or dream deprived in the mornings. So try not to drink. It doesn't help at all. Smoking blocks your nose and stops you from clearing out your airway. So try and avoid that. Also, it makes, if you do want an operation, it makes it very hard for us to fix you when you're a smoker. There are exercises that one can do whilst they're waiting to see the doctor. And I've got some exercises that I've got on my YouTube channel. There are 3 videos now. I've just released one last week where I am teaching you throat and tongue and palate exercises, which open up and strengthen up the muscles in your throat. So that way they don't keep collapsing down and blocking your breathing. This seems to work best in slightly older people who've only just started snoring. And these are the people who, because you lose about 3% muscle mass each year, they've lost so much muscle mass, they're so weak now in the muscles in their throat, that they need to exercise to stop the throat from collapsing in. But it does happen and work for all sort of sleep apnea people. And I think apparently it's about a 50% reduction in your snoring and sleep apnea. There's all sorts of things that you can do if you feel like you've got a tongue-based problem. Say if you're lying on your back and you seem to only have a problem lying on your back, then something known as a tongue retaining device is quite useful. It's like a suction cap that pulls your tongue out of your mouth. I don't know if I could call it a long-term option, but it's a stopgap. It's a bridging therapy whilst you're waiting for something good, like a CPAP device or a mandibular advance device or surgery or something. If you want to get your tongue out of the way, you know you have problems lying on your back and you can't get yourself to sleep on your side, well, then the tongue-retaining device pulls your tongue out of your mouth and stops it from falling back, flopping back, and blocking your breathing. There is another device, if you don't want to wear that, known as an INAP device. That is, it feels like the exact opposite of CPAP, where it sucks the air out of your mouth. In a way, that's great, because what it does is it flaps the palate forward, pulls the tongue out of the throat so that you can breathe normally through your nose and your mouth is closed, and you don't have to wear a mandibular advancement device, the gum shield that brings your jaw forward. It works brilliantly on some people and not so great on other people. But if it works for you, then use it. It's such a lovely device with minimal side effects or risks. But often it's not to do with the tongue, and it may be due to something else that's going on. I've talked about mandibular advancement devices before. These are devices that you often can get from your dentist. I'd probably move away from getting these ones over the counter or from Amazon, where you sort of heat them up in some kettle water and then put them in your mouth and let it make impressions that way. Those sort of boil in the bag type mandibular advancement devices have a rather poor sort of quality rating. They don't last very long. They don't hold onto your teeth very well. They're not very customizable. They're quite uncomfortable to wear. So I definitely recommend you going to your local dentist, or even better, going to see someone at the British Society of Dental Sleep Medicine and asking one of those practitioners if they would make you a mandibular advancement device, because they're much more comfortable and they can be calibrated or titrated to your needs. For example, if you're wearing a device and you put it in your mouth and you pull your jaw forward, your partner might say, "Oh, wow, you didn't snore at all last night and you feel great." But your jaw might really, really hurt and your teeth might feel all loose and it just doesn't feel comfortable, and you're dreading the next night where you have to wear it. Well, with these more expensive mandibular advancement devices, you can dial it down a little bit to the point where it's not so painful. And all you have to do is make sure that you haven't dialed it down so much that you start snoring again or having sleep apnea again. Having that ability to calibrate it is really useful. And it's something that often takes about 3 months to get the levels just right. CPAP and BiPAP and all these other things, I think most people know about. It's a mask that goes on your face and pumps air in. We've talked about having a good nasal airway, not having big tonsils, And it works really well with people with a lateral pharyngeal wall collapse. You know, that side wall of your throat that's collapsing in, where I talked about pharyngeal cushions. It's not so great, I think, for people with a big tongue problem. So if you've got a big tongue, it's quite hard for CPAP to move your tongue out of the way. And sometimes I say to people, well, why don't you wear a mandibular advancement device and the CPAP at the same time so that your tongue is moved out of the way and the air can get into your lungs? That's a difficult combination, but it works really well in a lot of people. Now, I'd often talk about surgery at this point, but I noticed that I've been talking on for a really long time and I'm trying not to. It's my first podcast, but I should talk about it. Now, there are loads of different operations out there. I think I do 40-something. The problem is there are so many. I don't know which one to do in each person. Everyone is slightly different. Not everyone has the same configuration of problems as someone else. So the way to work out which operation to have, or even sometimes which device, because you decide not to go for any device, not to try out anything before seeing your doctor, the ENT doctor, the way we work it out is by doing something known as a drug-induced sleep endoscopy. So this is a test that we do not to find out how bad you are, which is what the sleep study, the polysomnography, teaches us. It doesn't tell you how many times you stop breathing every hour or whatever. It tells you why you have obstructive sleep apnea. It tells you where in your throat your problem is occurring, which part of your throat is blocking your breathing. Because from a surgeon point of view, with sort of 40-something different operations in his tool bag, we need to know where to direct our attention. So what we do is we bring people into hospital, we give them a tiny bit of sedation, let them fall asleep in front of us. There's a telescope at the back of your throat, and at the point where you start sleeping and snoring, we can see that going on in your throat. We can see the vibrating tissues. We go, that's the location where the noise has been generated, which is important, but not that important. The more important level is working out where the obstruction is, and often they're in two different places. If you look at the back of your throat, you can see, it's the tongue falling back, or it's the tonsils blocking your breathing, or it's the lateral pharyngeal wall, or all the other places in your throat that can cause obstruction. And this obstruction is setting off snoring in this location, or whatever the combination is. Then we go, as I did this morning, I showed a bunch of patients, look, this is what I found. Here are all the problems at the back of the throat. And then they said, well, how do you fix it? And I said, well, you can have this device for this area. You can have this device for this area. We can have these three or four operations. And then here are all the choices you have. And now all we have to do is work out what the pros and cons are for each of these, what the success rates, failure rates, risks, complications are for each of these. And then you just choose which procedure, device, exercise you want to go ahead with. Once we can work out what the plan is, once we know how bad you are, where the problem is, and what treatments out there are available to you, the whole thing becomes so much easier. You're not sort of doing this trial and error where I'll try this, hopefully it'll work, and it doesn't work, this thing's rubbish. What you're trying to do is diagnose the problem with the drug-induced sleep endoscopy where I'm watching you sleep. And then you can work out, this is what I need to do. I've got a plan now, finally, and I know the end is in sight. So that's how I do it. I often do say the plan and then check the sleep study. If it's better, great. If it's not quite there yet, we go, right, we'll do another drug-induced sleep endoscopy, find out what's left over and touch up that bit and keep going until the AHI or the symptoms or all the problems that you have with sleep disorder breathing have been fixed. And then we say goodbye and say, look, if there's any problems, come back. But that's how it works on the NHS. Once we've worked out through a drug-induced sleep endoscopy where the problem is, and I'll talk about, I think, drug-induced sleep endoscopy in another podcast because it's quite a big subject. Once we've worked out where the problem is, next thing we've got to do is work out what surgery to do, assuming that all the other devices and things haven't really worked for this person. And I don't think that's quite how it works. It's multimodal. We do use this device, we'll have this operation, then we take that device off and we'll do this operation. It should be very liquid, very flexible. But anyway, trying to make it simple, fixing the nose by straightening up the septum, shrinking down the turbinates, removing the polyps, removing the tonsils or shrinking down the tonsils. Latoplasty, that's operations on the palate, the dangly thing hanging down. That doesn't really cure sleep apnea. It's mostly for the snoring. And sometimes it can get stretched. There can be a lot of redundancy in the tissues around the palate, and that can help with the snoring. But it doesn't help with obstructive sleep apnea. And there's some videos in my channel about that. There are operations on the side wall of your throat, the bit where the tonsils attach to, where those pharyngeal cushions I talked to you about were. The two main ones, I mean, there are loads of modifications of each of these. The two or three main ones would be the expansion pharyngoplasty, and that was made by Kenny Pang over in Singapore. Really, really amazing operation, which you disconnect some muscles and reattach them somewhere else, and it pulls the palate forward, makes the side walls tighter so it doesn't keep collapsing in. And that works very well. There's another operation called the barbed suture palatal pharyngoplasty, which was designed by Professor Vicini in Italy and Forli, who's another great surgeon, and where you're stitching the side wall of the throat back, stopping it from falling in, like a facelift or a throat lift. And that really helps, stops everything from collapsing in. And there are other things as well, suspension sutures and all sorts of stuff going on. But I won't bore you with that because those are the lateral pharyngeal wall surgeries. And then there's all the tongue-based surgeries. Sometimes there is extra tonsil tissue sitting on the back of the tongue. What happens there is that you can shrink that down with something known as radiofrequency ablation, or basically cauterization of that area. And that slowly shrinks down so you can open up the space there. There's another thing called hoblation, which is a way of sort of vaporizing that tissue and shaving it down so you can get down to the muscle. You're not actually into the muscle, but you can shave it down so it's not the tongue muscle that's causing the problem, it's the lingual tonsil. So you remove the lingual tonsil that should have disappeared after puberty, and you're shaving it down to the muscle so that it heals over, and hopefully that will make enough room for you to breathe behind the back of your tongue. Sometimes with coblation, you can go into the tongue muscle itself. I try to avoid that because it's not very nice leaving you with a scar tissue on your tongue. You always feel like there's something there. And that's why I'm not generally a fan of TORS, that's transoral robotic surgery, where you're using a robot to remove a lot of the tongue. I think Professor Vicini, who's the grand master at this, he suggests, I think, 7 cubic centimeters of tongue to be removed. That's quite a lot. It's very painful, and got to be careful you don't damage the nerves of the tongue, and so your tongue doesn't work properly. So it needs a relatively skillful hand at it. We've sort of skipped that step, although it is available out there. It does work in very experienced hands. I generally move straight on to implants. Implants are devices that are implanted into you, which solve the tongue-based problem or other types of problem in your throat. So the main one that people may know of is the Inspire implant. That's the implant that's put into your chest, like a pacemaker, just near your collarbone, just underneath your collarbone on the right or sometimes the left side of your chest. And there's a little sensor that goes to your lung that monitors when you are breathing. And then another sensor or another wire that goes over your collarbone, up your neck, towards just underneath your chin, to a nerve called the hypoglossal nerve. And this is all inside your body, so you don't see it from the outside. And this wire stimulates the hypoglossal nerve, which pulls your tongue forward out of the way. So when you turn this machine on at night with a remote control, each time you take a breath, the tongue is moved forward gently out of the way so your tongue doesn't keep falling back and blocking your breathing. That's really, really useful. I mean, it's been done, I'm sure, 90, 95,000 times in this world, mostly in America and Germany. And so we've got a lot of research data on it. We know it helps an awful lot of people out there, typically about 70% reduction in their obstructive sleep apnea. And the rest we can almost deal with other operations if necessary. But a 70% reduction in sleep apnea is better than most things. There is another newer implant come out called the Genio implant, or the implant made by Nyxoah. And that's an implant which is a bit like a chip that sits underneath your chin. So it's one incision, there's no pacemaker element to it, and stimulates both the nerves, the left and the right nerve of your tongue. And it opens up the back of the tongue and also opens up, you know, that lateral wall area I was telling you about, the pharyngeal cushions area. That area is opened up as well, according to the preliminary research that's come out. And it seems to do a really good job for all different parts of your throat. We're still waiting for loads of good quality data to come out, but it's at the moment licensed for this. So the data is pretty good. So we're just quite excited because at that point, you don't really need the drug-induced sleep endoscopy. You don't really need to know where your problem is. You can officially go straight ahead and put this implant in. It should work on all patients with obstructive sleep apnea. I'm a little bit boring. I've been doing this for many years and I still do a drug-induced sleep endoscopy, but I am looking forward to seeing these results. And I am doing this on patients to try and work out whether or not this would work or not. So yeah, I'm really excited by that. There is a new implant coming in the future, which I'm helping to design with other surgeons and sort of researchers around the world, called the Restira implant. That's an implant which hopefully, the idea is that you sit in a clinic chair without an anesthetic, you'll probably need some numbing cream or injection in your neck. And then with an ultrasound, you find the nerve and then you inject the implant, this very small implant, into your neck. And at that point, we can put the implant right next to the nerve where you want it to, without doing a, you know, an hour-long, two-hour-long operation to put this implant just where we need it to be. So that's very exciting. We can put it on both sides. You can put it on other nerves like the ansa cervicalis and other nerves that we know that seem to help us with obstructive sleep apnea. All of this is really exciting stuff. It's a whole new area of treatment for obstructive sleep apnea, and it seems to be, at the moment, working really well. I talked earlier about what's known as a BIMAX surgery, or mandibular maxillary advancement, where you pull the skeleton of the face forward. It's roughly the same level of benefit as an implant. I think the data I've seen was about 68%, but it seems to work best for tongue-based problems. And it's not ideal for everyone, but it's a great operation. If your maxillofacial surgeon looks at you and says, yes, I think this would really work for you, they'll do some x-rays and scans and things like that. I often leave out this last treatment option, which is called tracheostomy. I've offered it twice, I think, in my lifetime. It's basically a hole in the neck. So you bypass all the blockages and you breathe through a hole in your neck. You can still talk and you can still eat and things like that. But if that's the only way to get around your sleep apnea for the time being, then that might be the only way to do it. It effectively cures it. That is 100% cure rate, if you want to call it a cure. You're just bypassing all the obstructive bits of your throat. It's not very nice, and it's not for everyone. Sometimes it's like, look, I don't want any operations on my throat, or there's a problem with my jaw, I can't open my mouth, all those sorts of things. Or I'm trying desperately to lose the weight. Can you give me a tracheostomy, and then I'll lose the weight, and then we can take the tracheostomy out and let it heal up. So there's all sorts of different procedures out there. So it's quite bright, I think, the future for sleep-disordered breathing and the treatment options out there. In fact, my friend Michael Story and I are putting together another thing which helps people with low arousal threshold, which is a phenotype. That means people who are very sensitive sleepers, the upper airway resistance syndrome people sometimes, and women who've just had a baby and they've all grown up now, but they still can't sleep properly, the insomnia people. All of these things, we've worked out a way to make them less low arousal threshold. And I'm very excited. We're thinking about making it into an app to train people to sleep deeper at night and improve their cognitive ability. Look, we're really excited. I'll have to keep quiet about that because we're still trying to put that together. But I'll let you know more about that as it comes through. Anyway, back to this. I've talked about all the different treatment options out there. And the idea is you do a few, you lose a bit of weight, you feel a bit healthier. And then when it's all plateaued off, roughly about 6 or 9 months later, you do the questionnaires again, you do a sleep study again, see where you're at, and you go, oh my God, I'm cured. Or you say, I feel better, but I wouldn't mind to feel even better than that. I'm not quite perfect yet. And so you have this long-term sort of relationship with your surgeon or your doctor or your physician, and try and work out how best to look after you, to edge you closer towards normality. There's not going to be one operation that fixes everything. It doesn't quite work like that. Even an implant, even MMA, there's a little bit of data out there for maxillary or palatal expansion. I think only one or two papers show that makes any difference. It's mostly because you've opened up the nose. So all of these treatment options out there can help in their own ways. But what I think is more important is working out which patients it would work in and then target the right treatment for the right patient. Wow, I've talked for a long time. I hope this works, this podcast idea. I hope that has been useful for some people out there. It's given you a broad outlook of all the things to understand sleep apnea and sleep disorder breathing, the ways to investigate it, the signs and symptoms, the treatment options available. And I should say that, as I've mentioned before, I'd like to work in an MDT environment. So I only fix the sleep apnea side of it. That's all I do. But people, as I said before, have insomnia. You should be also seen by a psychiatrist or an insomnia specialist. They also have parasomnias, all the neurological diseases, restless legs and things like that. You need to be seen by a neurologist as well. So the team needs to get together to fix you. Some people have problems with endocrine problems, diabetes, menopausal issues. You need to see an endocrinologist for that, or a gynecologist, whoever sorts out their endocrine problems. A cardiologist. So a GP to knit all of these things together. It is really hard. But I'm hoping that this podcast is giving you a little bit of direction as I sort of go through the whole sort of a brief overview of everything. And I will, hopefully, if this is received well, do more of these. I probably won't talk quite as long as this. If any of you are still listening, congratulations, you've made it. Have some water. I think I need some water. Thank you very much for listening. Do take care. Bye-bye.